warm welcome to our Thursdays with David Foster Wallace series, where we every week read a section of the infamous Infinite Jest with the hope, of course, of finishing the book by the end of the year. Today's section is pages 795 to 883 in the 20th anniversary Back Bay Books edition of the text, published, of course, by Little Brown and Company. Getting started here, a couple of announcements. One is that we have a lot to get through today. We are taking a fika, like a coffee break, in the middle of the episode today, so don't fear if this episode is over an hour long or something. That is to be expected. I honestly just wanted a change of pace, and I feel like this change of pace of doing an episode that's like 1.75 times as long or twice as long as a normal episode of these mimics how the book is going at the end here. We just have these like immeasurably long sections, especially with Gately that we're about to get into. So I thought it would be a nice and a welcome change of pace, both for me and hopefully for you guys as well. Another thing is we have voting for Horrifying Classics going on. The votes are actually pretty unanimous so far, so that's been interesting for me to follow along with, but if you haven't voted yet and you would like to influence the decision for what books we read in October for this spooky season coming up here, go in the show notes for this section. Those are actually down in the comments box for this one, and you can find the link to vote. The last announcement is my peg for Patreon. Thank you to those of you who have already signed up. It's been really awesome just doing some extra stuff, doing some fun stuff with y'all. We have already spoiled the after episodes of DH&I to my patrons, so if you're not on Patreon and you want to know which topics we're covering for September in this series, we're finishing the book by the end of the month, actually, by the end of August 2020, so we have some extra topics we've been exploring here in the back behind the scenes of the show, and our Patreons were really graciously able to help us narrow down some topics, and finally we've shared that announcement today. So again, if you'd like to be a part of all of that, a part of the behind the scenes, a part of the decision making and the spoilers, of course, you can go to patreon.com/relevanceofliterature and follow us there. Alright, getting into the episode proper here, we're starting on page 795 after footnote 332, which is what we ended with in the last episode 2 weeks ago. We have this realization, or I had this realization pretty quickly, that Hal is the one that visited Enid's house early in the morning at 8 a.m. or something, and Hal is really the one that Jeanette was talking to. Jeanette was judging, basically, and being very harsh to. We'll get back into something that's a little sketchy about their encounter in a minute, but Hal has decided to go to a rather obscure NA meeting. He's sacrificing quite a bit to do this, though. He's skipping dinner, he is taking the truck that he shares with Pemulus and the others, and he's just driving all the way out to this very obscure location. And that is, of course, his hope that he won't get recognized in any way. But what I find notable about his going to the meeting is that he's exhibiting some of the same behaviors with exploring NA as he was when he was actually addicted. So we talked a couple weeks ago about how there's this realization in the novel that addicted people just substitute one addiction for another, especially when they're early on in recovery. And I see how, you know, Hal skipped meals when he went to go get high, and that's super detrimental for a competitive athlete's body, and he's doing the same thing in his recovery already, which I find, again, just really interesting and quite notable for Hal's early journey. He calls his abstainment from hope, he calls it abandon all hope, and you can see through this term just how much his psyche really is affected by his cessation of taking all of these drugs, well, I guess the one drug to be more precise, and the narrator himself or herself or itself recognizes this abandon all hope term as quite a bad sign. I saw this as a connection almost between the narrator and drug abuse, and I'm interested in how that connection will develop as we get on with the episode today. So in the narrative, Hal has come to the NA building, and it's a really strange building. It's weird, it's maze-like, it has these weird smells, and the lighting is sort of yellowish. The walls are orange, and there's sort of like this orange-beige theme. I believe one of the rooms is green as well, but what's cool to me about this like color and how DFW emphasizes this color in the scene is orange is the opposite color of blue. And blue, as we know, is a big symbol of truth. It's a big symbol of clarity in the novel as well. Whereas this orange, it's sort of like a sign already that this NA meeting is going to be the opposite of helpful, the opposite of true. So the scene when he gets to the meeting is really strange. It's quite funny, actually. I had a lot of fun in, enjoying this section. So the scene is there's this really heavy Norwegian guy, and I just can't help but laugh at DFW's descriptions here because I'm half Norwegian, and he's just describing my whole family and how they're just absurdly blonde, you know, the blue eyes, all of that. So it was funny for me on a different level, observing DFW's comments about this heavy Norwegian guy. So he's the head of this meeting, and there's this guy named Kevin who's just sobbing. He's just sobbing, okay? And we learn later in the scene there's a guy named Jim. I don't know what connection this name has to our potential narrator here, Jim and Candenza, but there's a guy named Jim and he's eating yogurt. I just thought it was sort of ironic that Jim was here at an NA meeting when the Jim in real life really didn't. He pretty much abstained from meetings when he was sober. Like, he didn't go regularly, especially not Gately regularly. These men in a circle are all in sweaters. Just, I sort of imagine, like, sweaters and khakis, you know? The typical, almost uniform of people in a certain social class of a certain race. And they're all holding teddy bears. And they're talking as they get into this scene with Kevin sobbing, Kevin bringing out why he might be addicted to certain drugs, why he might have dependency issues. They're talking more and more about this topic of an inner infant. And so the goal here, at least for the Norwegian guy at the head of the meeting, is for Kevin to explore and to bring out his inner infant. He does this in many ways by sobbing, by having literally just like spit and goo come out of him like a child, holding the bears, and also literally crawling at some points on his hands and knees here. So it's sort of a, to me, it became sort of like a morose or disturbing picture, especially seeing it through Hal's eyes. Hal starts to lose his objectivity pretty quickly, and he's like really trying to hang in there, look at it, and then he makes this realization that the Kevin that's crying is Kevin Bain, who is Oren's best friend's, old best friend's, Marlin's brother. Older brother, rather, and when he realizes that it's Kevin, and Kevin, as he knows, has never had, like, serious dependency issues, serious stuff going on, at least that's what Hal has convinced himself, he realizes, wow, this meeting is really a sham. And my question here is, could Johnette have basically sacked Hal? Like, could she have not helped him deliberately? Hal realizes the pamphlet is several years old, it has like dirty stains on it, it's just kind of gross and decrepit, and he's wondering, would Johnette have done that to him? Would Johnette have sort of spited him without knowing him? And I think it's entirely possible. And I'm not sure how this meeting will come to affect his problems with his addiction, but I'm really interested into how this event definitely contributes to his development and his progression with his addiction. One other thing I wanted to mention for this scene is that the bears, the teddy bears that they're all holding, almost become separate characters within themselves. And I thought that was a really poignant way to sort of emphasize this inner infant charade that they're all playing at. And again, it's these grown men with teddy bears in their arms. And the teddy bears, they wave at them. The guy eating yogurt is like feeding the teddy bear yogurt. They're all matching as well. So there's sort of like a connection, like a cultish vibe to it. And so, yeah, it's just interesting that the bears become props and characters simultaneously within the text. A new thread here, and this is a long one. We are getting into much longer threads than we've experienced in the past. I think that I really enjoyed in the earlier parts of the book these little short threads, especially with the medical attaché in the first 300 pages, just like one or two sentences about his status. Really interesting to me how that was integrated into the text. That's something I haven't seen really before. I'm more used to these long sections, getting through them, figuring them out just because of my other reading. I love reading classics, for example. We're doing an episode on Twilight. We're finishing that next week. That'll air on Monday. And so, you know, those are long books. The newest one is 650 pages. So I'm used to sticking with a narrative for quite a long time. And I'm interested in the shift here, though. And I'm wondering, you know, basically, this whole book, at least at this point to me, is leading up to the epilogue, which is the first chapter of the book. So it's like we get this like reveal in the first chapter. It's not unlike Twilight in some ways. Don't hate me for saying that. But, it's sort of like this first chapter should be placed at the end, right? And we're just leading up to this climax of Hal being totally non-communicative with others. And so we get like glimpses of this, and I'll point them out as we go along. But I'm just wondering at this weird shift in the text where we get these like long, drawn-out narratives, what the usefulness of that is in particular. And it's interesting also just to note that I'm wondering, you know, what kind of reward is are these long sections? I feel like it is very rewarding to stick in and know the characters and have some anticipation about what's going to happen. But I almost felt like all of this shifting around, all of this like total confusion was pretty rewarding as a reader before. So I'm wondering also, what you guys think about these longer sections? Are they rewarding in the same way as earlier parts of the novel? What do you guys think about all of that? So, Gately's in the hospital. He's alive. We have known this, sort of. We've had hints in the last 100+ pages or so, but we haven't checked in with him personally in a while, and he is watching the ceiling basically breathe. And so he's drifting in and out of consciousness, and to him it looks like the ceiling is like coming in, going out, like the tide a little bit. And it reminds him of this scene from his childhood when he lived near the beach once, and there was a hole in the roof of his nursery. So the crib was placed right under the hole. And they had this tarp over the hole, and so when it got windy, the tarp would flux in and out just like that. And I immediately made the connection to this inner infant motif in the last section. And this comes up again and again in the subsequent sections here in this chunk of 40 pages. And so I just thought that was weird that Gately was having this infant connection, and of course, he's sort of the poster boy of AA and NA in some ways in this novel, just because he becomes dependent on it. He's trying to, for example, figure out this God thing and this connection to religion and higher power in regards to his addiction. So he's almost practicing this inner infant thing while he's recovering, while he's in this intense state of refusing narcotics. So Tiny Ewill comes and he's talking to Gately, and he tells this long story about his third grade self. And Tiny Ewill is a kid, you know, he was the president or the leader of this club called the Money Stealers Club. And so there were all these like rough Irish rugrats that were, as kids, they went around and they dressed as a hockey team. And Ewell would come and he was dressed pretty nicely and he would convince people in the neighborhoods that they went to donate to the hockey team. And so Ewell, he develops this knack and he discovers this talent for speaking and for convincing people of things. And so early on, he becomes even corrupted by that awareness of that talent. So they get a bunch of money by this ruse of being in this poor hockey team who is, they're the underdogs, all of this. And then Ewell goes a step further and he says, "Hey guys, let me keep the money can that we have been collecting money with. I'll put it in an account for all of us." And he starts embezzling money and buying himself lavish toys, candy all the time. And how it ends here is that the other kids, the Rugrats, they realize, hey, there's something going on with Ewell. And he returns the money. He steals from his parents in order to return the money to the kids. And they beat him up anyway. And what's interesting to me in this section is that he's not bothered as a third grader by what the actual kids' responses would be. He's not worried about peer validation at this point. He's worried about his parents' responses. And in some sense, he's not even worried about the acts themselves. He's not worried about the act of embezzlement itself, when he's a third grader. He's worried about really like what his parents would think of him. And I think this is a window into this theme of selfishness versus selflessness in the novel, because it's sort of the pinnacle of selfishness, right? To sort of like forgive yourself and then look to the people you admire most, the people who are most giving to you, for their response about something bad you've done. So it's an interesting theme that comes up. Again, you could connect this back to the inner infant stuff that was going on. And I don't think it's a coincidence that we have all these connections, these little links to between sections here. The sections really are starting to blend in a really curated sort of way. One thing I noticed during a lot of this longer section and the sections after this is that Gately becomes an unreliable narrator just because of how much pain he's in. So he is really in and out throughout this whole thing. This story in particular is relatively clear, especially compared to the people who visit him next. But I would say this sort of like unreliability factor towards Gately is new, and something that we definitely need to keep tabs on for the remainder of the novel. So there's a visit, supposedly, from Pat Monteagin, and she's terribly worried about Gately, and Gately's just really not sure if it's real. Her behavior seems sort of on track, but he's sort of disturbed by what she leaves him with. I think she cries, if I'm remembering correctly. So Gately does not trust his memory, his intuition on this. He has no idea if Pat was like really there or not. He thinks so, but is not sure. I think Pat was there, like personally, but who knows? Who knows? And that's intentional, again, I think, to show Gately's unreliability or his sudden unreliability as a perspective here. And so we know that the narrator is fielding all of Gately's experiences and thoughts. And so it's interesting to me that the narrator would bring in this new and sudden unreliability. There's also a visit from Calvin Thrust. He's another one of the staffers at Ennett House. So he's just summarizing information. I'm going to hit on the key points of his visit. So, first, Green refuses to rat out Lens. I really think that Green is just traumatized by it all. Just that scene where he's behind the tree and there are Canadians everywhere and all of this. I think he's just really traumatized and he liked Lens. They had a close-ish relationship, so I think that trauma is something that Green will have to work through in the remainder of the novel, probably after the novel has finished, to be honest. Secondly, Lenz is basically dismissed on scene. So Calvin Thrust was there on scene eventually. Gately's like bleeding out on the couch at this moment. And he takes Lenz into the back and he says, look, like, you got basically two options, both involve leaving. And that creates a lot of tension at this moment in the narrative, because Lenz is needed for the legal issues that arise, because one of the Canadians was killed by Yolanda and Clinette. So yeah, there's a lot of legal issues that are starting to rise up just because of the intricacy of the case and the situation, and Lenz, as well as the gun that the Canadian had in his hand, that tricked out gun that Gately was noticing, that's missing. So those are the two big missing pieces to this legal puzzle that they're figuring out. And Gately is scared crapless about this parole situation and wondering if he killed anyone, because we don't know whether Gately was really contributing to killing someone at this point, and that's going to be a key piece for the rest of his future, which I as a reader care about because he's such an interesting character, so full of depth, and I think he's one of the most selfless characters in the novel as well, and so that makes me want to root for him even more. Especially, you know, he's a drug addict, but he is an aware drug addict, and he's doing his best, and he's living in the moment, and we'll talk more about that later, about his shift later in the novel, his realizations about all that. But I really appreciate that change in this novel, because there's so many characters who are self-motivated, they're selfish, they're conceited, they're blind to it as well, they're not really self-aware in that way. So it's a nice breath of fresh air to see and hear so much of and from Gately. And then we get a little bit of description, as I was talking about a bit earlier, about Gately's trek to the hospital. Joelle is still doting on him for selfish reasons, or no, I don't know yet. And Gately cannot speak in this hospital scene. He can't speak. He's making these like meowing sounds, and then he turns into mooing. And so he's just really, he can't speak. We don't know why until much later. And that makes him really afraid. So he's a bundle of fears at this point, which is, he's very insecure in some ways in earlier in the novel, but I feel like his physicality is something that does really secure him in his life and his journey, especially with addiction. And losing that part just leaves him with the mental troubles that he's really fostering here. We also hear that Hester Thrail is long gone. She left her car. She just ran from the scene, and no one's seen her since. I wonder if she will be subjected from the entertainment. More on that later. And the last of Kate Gompert. The last we hear of Kate Gompert, I've been told, in the whole novel, is what Calvin reports, which is basically where we left off with her. You know, she was mugged, and that's it. You know, she eventually stumbles into the bar situation with Maraith, but Calvin doesn't know that, of course. And it's sort of become one of the mysteries of the novel in my mind, and this is something we'll address in the after episodes for sure. Email Minty, another resident at Emmett House, is also about to get the shoe. He put an arrow headband, so one of those headbands that looks like there's an arrow going through your head. He put it over this old lady's head in the yard, who sort of camps out in the yard all day. And he's just been doing he's been engaging in a couple of behaviors that are just unacceptable in terms of Emmett House rules, Emmett House etiquette. Clinette H, she has also brought cartridges from ETA to Emmett House, but the thing is that the staff has to review them first, and so that might have been why we saw a bunch of cartridges in Pat Montesian's office when Maraith was getting interviewed. And it's interesting, you know, if the staff... It brings up a lot of hypotheticals in a certain sense. So if the staff start viewing the cartridges, one of them is bound to come across one of the copy of Infinite Jest. Maybe they have a couple, but the copy of Infinite Jest that Pat has. And I wonder if removing Gately from the situation is intentional here. Like, we're not supposed to imagine a future in which Gately is the one to view the cartridges, but rather Jeanette or something. So it's kind of an explosive setup. It's like that rule in literature: when a gun is introduced, the gun will be fired. It's sort of like Infinite Jest is the gun here. And so there's a loaded gun in Pat Monteason's office shelf system, and that is Infinite Jest. That's my metaphor. And so when will the gun get fired is my question. And Gately, it's interesting because I feel that a lot of people would read this as selflessness. But Gately's really worried about Enet running without him, especially the food and the meal times, as I noted in the last episode. And yeah, so I figure it's selfish because I really think that he gets some enjoyment from being in charge, from having that control over Enet's residence, you know, and he gets peeved when Joelle Van Dyne and the other girl aren't going to entertain his meatloaf. And so I figure it's his one thing that he allows himself to be selfish for is his control of other people and his like taking care of other people. But I do feel again that a lot of people would take that as selflessness. I wonder what you all think about that. Let me know in the comments. And finally here, the people at Enet House that witnessed this fight with the Canadians, they will witness for Gately if it comes to that. And there's a couple of, again, legal issues that are as yet unresolved in the narrative. All right, a new thread, but different people, different circumstances here. There's a visit from G. Day, and he says that Jeanette is feeding the residents spam. She's having some creative issues with spam, which I find really funny. It's sort of like the residents can't get a break in some ways. And there's also news that some brownies were made for Gately, but he can't eat them, of course, because he can't even speak. He doesn't know yet that there's a tube down his throat. So it's sort of like a dramatic irony thing. Like, we know there's something happening with him. There's probably medical procedures involved in his not speaking. We also know where the brownies are. The brownies are at the nurse's station. They're sort of like handing them out randomly. And of course, Day and also Gately to a certain extent don't know those things. And what's interesting to me, what's kind of cool about this is that. So we realize that Gately's perspective is limited by his pain and his awareness in the situation, but also it's limited in the way that his visitors are limited as well. So we get a lot from his visitors. It's almost like the visitors' stories take the forefront for a while, but no one who visits Gately notes the condition really that Gately's in. So there's a couple parts later where they say like Gately look really horrible, stuff like that. But no one vis who visits like points out the tube that's in Gately's throat. And so what contributes to Gately's pain, I believe, in this like mental state that he's in is him just not knowing all the unknowns. And yeah, I certainly can relate to that as well with all this medical stuff. So, Day apparently had a brother who was disabled and is afraid of leaves, which reminds me of this movie called Sweetie. Really good movie, really good film, but the main character is afraid of trees. And there's sort of, it's, this one is a little harder to pick up on because the story is not as clear as Ewell's, and it sort of mimics again how closely Gately is paying attention. Gately is more distracted during Day's conversation than he was with Ewell's or with Calvin Thrust's. There's also a ghost-like figure. There's a figure with a hat that Gately keeps seeing, and he thinks that it's a policeman of some sort of person there to reprimand him. And then there's also this sort of ghost-like figure that he sees in the corner. I think it might be Joelle, or his fantasy of Joelle, maybe. Sort of this, like, mysterious, like, wraith-like figure. The veil, maybe, is an image that he's calling up. I have no idea what the significance of the ghost-like figures are, especially considering what happens next in the novel. Before we get to that, though, one last narrative development before we get into something really important is Gately has this dream about this Oriental woman, and it's not his first dream about an Oriental woman, as she's called in the novel, but this woman has acne scars just, like, all over her face, and she's looking down at him, meaning that she's probably really giant. She has this authority position over him, which, again, Gately relies a lot on his physicality, and it's not something he's used to having someone who he would consider probably inferior looking down upon him in this instance. And there's a dog there as well. And I wonder, I just sort of wonder, there's a development that comes next. Again, I'm building the suspense here. There's a development that comes next that just, like, has shifted my thoughts about dreams and about a lot of the circumstances in the novel. And so it's a fitting dream because it reminds me a lot of Lens and how Lens, like, killed dogs, and him killing dogs was the catalyst for this whole fight and the reason why Gately's in the hospital. And also Lens robs two Chinese women. In where we last have caught up with him, he's closing in to rob them. So I just feel like it's sort of like giving Gately, either Gately is realizing this himself or the dream is being fed to him, that there's just sort of these, like, themes and these answers that are all tied up in this dream about Lens and about the situation he's in. So, finally, the big reveal. A wraith visits Gately, and it's this, like, nerdy guy, really tall, with high water pants, and he's speaking to Gately telekinetically, so he's speaking through thoughts with Gately. And Gately compares it to a confessional many times, and that reminds me of his dream that he had earlier in the novel about there's, like, an AA or an NA meeting, and everyone's on the floor praying. And it's when Gately's processing his thoughts about this higher power thing, which he hasn't done completely yet. But there's a meat hook that, like, comes and grabs people and hoists them out of this little area. And I don't know why, but that sort of dreamlike state, maybe the prose of this moment as well, they just seem very connected to me. And making me think again, maybe his dreams are coming from an outside source. And the wraith is feeding, he starts feeding words from, like, ballet, annulation, all these weird, like, I think gerrymandering is one of the words. He just feeds these words to Gately. Reminds me of Hal, actually. And then I realized, like, based on the context of the words, this is Jim and Condensa. The wraith is Jim and Condensa visiting Gately, which is the trippiest thing I've ever read, I think. Trippiest realization I've made so far in this novel. And so Jim starts talking about Hal in this amazing section. I would just recommend reading this again and again and again if you guys have missed this or have only read it once, because it's just flawless. So Hal, he talks about this concept of a figurant, and so in film, and he talks about his relationship with film and everything, more clues about his identity. In films, when there's a scene, like, for example, in a restaurant, there are all these background people, right? And they're talking, but they have no volume. So there's, like, they are talking, but to no avail. The talking is just for show. And those are figurants. And he is relating Hal to a figurant. He's saying Hal became silent in the later years of Jim's life, in his mind at least, in Jim's mind. And what strikes me here is that Jim is projecting his feelings about his childhood and his father onto Hal. Which I think Avril actually does the same thing, right? There's that scene with Mario in the mirror, and Avril's really just seeing his reflection, really just responding to Mario's reflection, as well as all her kids' reflections, and them to her in a certain respect. So it really does feel like the parents, both parents, one of their fatal flaws as parents are just them projecting their feelings, their thoughts, their motivations onto their kids. All right, I'm going to read from the top of page 838 here. I'm just going to read and enjoy this section a little bit with you guys. Quote, he says, just imagine the horror of spending your whole iterant, lonely Southwest and West Coast boyhood trying unsuccessfully to convince your father that you even existed. To do something well enough to be heard and seen, but not so well that you became seen a screen just for his own, the dad's, projections of his own failure and self-loathing. Failing ever to be really seen, gesturing wildly through the distilled haze, so that in adulthood you still carried the moist, flabby weight of your failure, ever to make him hear you really speak. Carried it on through the animate years of your increasingly slumped shoulders, only to find near the end that your very own child had himself become blank, inbent, silent, frightening, mute, i.e., that his son had become what he, the wraith, had feared as a child, he, the wraith, was. So, again, it's just like this floating kind of section. It's beautifully written, beautifully done, and I really like this section in the novel. I think it's so vital to our understanding of the text and to our big question about what the narrator is, who the narrator is. And again, this section really shifted my perspective on looking at critical questions of perspective in the novel. So we learn here that Infinite Jest was composed in 90 days, that Jim Incandenza was sober for at least 89 of those days, and that Infinite Jest was meant for Hal so that he could communicate to Hal. Like, he created Infinite Jest so he could finally feel that he was getting through to Hal. My question is, why is Jim there? This is what Gately is asking himself the whole time. Why does Jim reveal himself to Gately? You know, why not just to Hal? I mean, I guess he is afraid of Hal somewhat, especially with his non-communicativeness. He's afraid of seeing himself maybe in Hal. But I'm like, why now? Why is Jim there? Why now? I guess I can answer that. Possibly Jim wants to confuse him, because Hal or Gately is recovering, right? So Gately's in this stupor. He's really in and out. He doesn't know what's dreaming, what's a dream, and what's reality, really. So maybe Jim reveals himself to Gately at this moment because Gately's vulnerable enough to accept him. Also, he can't move, so he couldn't run away if he wanted to. And so, yeah, I think maybe this like implicit doubt that he gives Gately is important to his reveal. But Gately really thinks that Jim is this incarnation of the disease, so addiction, and I don't know if that's gonna prove useful to Gately. We'll see. We'll see. I just find this section so bizarre. So, Gately starts remembering his childhood again. He is remembering the MP's meticulousness and how him and his mother never talked about the MP when the MP was gone. This is notable because the MP beat Gately's mother every day, like clockwork almost, it seems like. So it's just weird how there's sort of this presence and then this absence, and there's no in between in this household that Gately's remembering. MP, I will just like bring up here that is this they're the same initials as Madame Psychosis. Madame Psychosis, the name, the character, whatever, has a lot to do with transformation. And I'm wondering, you know, I was just sort of trying to puzzle this out earlier. What transformation occurred in Gately's life with the MP? Was it sort of his development? Was it his, was it the addiction itself? And I'm wondering what you guys think about that, because this is not a Jim and Condensa fabricated use of MP, which I sort of relate to Madame Psychosis right away. This is the only instance of the novel, actually, that Jim and Condensa has not influenced in terms of the term Madame Psychosis. So yeah, I just find that to be a weird connection. I'm sure it's unintentional, but I do want to just sort of piece out a little bit more what this transformation piece is doing to Gately. There's an anecdote about MP, Gately's MP, and flies and how he just maims them. Like he takes off a wing and just watches them suffer for the rest of their lives. And Gately is bothered by this memory because he realizes that he never put them out of their misery. And I think what he's doing here in this memory is processing what happened to the Canadians, right? So he is like looking objectively at the situation, or I guess highly subjectively. I'm gonna rewrite that there. Highly subjectively at his situation of killing slash almost killing the Canadians, and he's looking down and saying, "I don't think I ever put them out of his misery." And this to me is a clue that he doesn't think he actually killed any of the Canadians, which I think is as far as thorough of an answer as we're gonna get in this section. Finally, to end here before our Fika, page 844. I'm just cataloging uses of phantods at this point. It's for a later episode, trust me. There's some semblance of hope here. Quote, "Something that's always given Gately the phantods." Fika, 1 minute, I'll be back. Welcome back from the break. I hope you enjoyed that royalty-free jazz from a minute there. We are looking at the next 40 pages of the novel, pages 845 to 883 here. 19th of November, YDAU starting out this section. We're back with Moraith, but it seems like he might have informed Steeply about the revelation with Joelle at Ennett House rather than the AFR, because we see that the AFR has moved on. They're going after the Auteur's family to try to get closer to them. So the AFR at this point is really following the USOUS, their plan. So it's interesting to see. We'll see what is going on with them later in the book, but we just know there's these little two tidbits here about Moraith. We also find the end to Lens. Okay, I don't know if I've gotten attached to Lens as a character at all. I certainly am interested in him. I think he has a lot to offer to this postmodernist kind of feeling to the book, just because a lot of his actions are just so absurd, morbid, but absurd. But here's the end. Lens becomes a test subject for Infinite Jest. He's found in the back of the Antoine's shop, messing with the severed digits of the last victim, which was the engineer from WYYY. And to massively understate his fate, good things are not going to follow for his future. We also get a thread here, really short, about how this AFR member named Balabase is selected to ambush these Quebecois tennis kids on their way to ETA. So their plan is to replace the tennis kids with AFR for the upcoming match at ETA. And it starts snowing as well. So they're doing their typical light mirror booby trap, and they're gonna hopefully can these kids, is what they're thinking. And it starts snowing, so the weather starts turning a little bit gray, a little bit gloomy. Next section here, Gately has a dream that Joelle Van Dyne has Winston Churchill's face, which I find so hilarious. I laughed out loud when I read that. Just because, again, it's so absurd. It's such an absurd thought. But of course, not unlikely at this point because Gately has never seen Joelle's face. I don't know if he has reason to believe that Joelle is horribly disfigured under the veil, but he certainly just has no idea. The veil is sort of a black box for him. And he's definitely seen that her body is fine. But again, her face and the veil, I think, present a problem for Gately and how he imagines her, and so for sure, the veil is like a black box for him. There is this thread about Mrs. Waite, and she was Gately's neighbor for a time when he was a child, and she was scorned. That's the best way I can put it. The neighborhood kids made fun of her for being a witch, for being dirty and disgusting, and Gately went over to her house a couple times, and it was against his mother's wishes, but sort of like a futile attempt at control. And so Mrs. Waite, she starts saving, right, for whatever it is. She literally stops smoking in order to save for this thing. And then Gately realizes she brings this big cake to a party that Gately was having. And he was sharing a birthday party at that time just because the parents of the other child with the birthday had, they felt bad about Gately's not having a party, so she brings this cake, and, you know, no one has seen her out of her house for a while. She's sort of a recluse, and it's a big deal for Gately and for, everyone else, it seems, that she's brought a cake for him. And so, yeah, I found that to be a kind of touching story, like, sort of an underdog type story. I don't know about the exact significance of it, except for this next part here, but she does, unfortunately, commit suicide thereafter. So Gately, that is, has another dream, and this time it is in Mrs. Waite's kitchen, and Joelle Van Dyne is sitting at the kitchen table where Mrs. Waite would sit, and she's playing the role of death. So the plot of Infinite Jest, as we discovered, is that it's Joelle Van Dyne as the lead actress, which is really interesting, again, the connections here between Gately's dream and the actual cartridge. And Joelle Van Dyne, the character in this film, is explaining that when you die, you're killed by a woman, and in your next life, that woman is your mother. And it's the same thing here, same exact premise, again, making me think, are Gately's dreams influenced somehow? Especially with his knowledge of her asthma and psychosis, he's on the precipice of understanding the missing parts to all of this in the novel. So, I don't know. I think it's reasonable to think that Gately is putting these pieces together himself, but also, where would he have gotten that piece, literally the plot of IJ, from, if not from Jim or from some other character? He's never viewed Infinite Jest. Unless he's immune somehow, because no one has come out of it alive, that we know of. So, yeah, again, it's just this big question mark section. My question here for you all is, how much influence does Jim have in all of this? Again, this is just a summary question here. This is beyond Gately's dreams, though. What about in the novel as a whole? It seems like Jim has more influence than we might have thought, especially considering we've seen him as a wraith now. But Jim might be able to maybe influence the thoughts of people and get inside people's heads and such, which would be useful for narration of a book like this, and indeed has proven useful because we have this semi-omniscient perspective that we're dealing with. But again, I'm not sure how much is predetermined on Jim's part, on DFW's part, and how much is just left up to the character's whims, the character's chances. Next section here, 851, 20th of November, YDAU, Gaudiamus Igitur. And we have this first-person narration for the first time in a long time. And Hal is waking up from another withdrawal nightmare. He's in a zoo, but there's no animals and no cages. Interesting, we could dive into that in a different episode, but that is the dream. It's snowing heavily outside, so this is a continuation, of course, of that 19th of November YDAU scene with Marith and the AFR. And Hal realizes that he has a feeling about tennis, one way or the other, and he realizes he wants it to be a snow day today. And I thought it when I read that, and I sort of looked at it from an objective point of view, I thought, well, of course he does. He's a 17-year-old, he's about to graduate, and tennis is his life, so he deserves a day off every once in a while. That's how I felt about music when I was that age. But Hal has been desensitized. He's been systematically desensitized, not only by DeLint and Shtit, but also by people like CT, the moms, his friends to a certain extent, right? And his competition with Wayne, I think, has been partly to desensitize him and keep that desensitization going throughout his tennis career. We know that one of Shtit's like ultimate goals for ETA players is for them to not care one way or the other about the show, about the fame, about the paparazzi, because Shtit thinks that that's the only way they have a chance in the show once they get there. Which I sort of agree with in some certain respects, but this weird like placidity that I keep encountering as a reader at ETA with Hal especially is not natural, especially not to Hal. So, he's been like systematically desensitized, as I said, by the institution, but also by the drugs and by the weed. And so for me, him quitting the weed is finally him getting back to himself and getting back to his own feelings, his own wishes. And there's just like several layers of almost irony here that ETA's system didn't work for Hal and it was really substance that worked for him. I found it very ironic when I took a step back and I looked at it critically. So in November, ETA has a fundraiser that pays for a lot of the season's expenses, especially like the European tours, etc. And the kids always play foreigners because this fundraiser is for their patrons, for lack of a better word. And these people they respond better, in CT's eyes at least, to like sort of a nationalistic perspective as well. So they play foreigners, they've played all these people, and this year they're playing Quebecois players. And so that is why we are having Quebecois people come to ETA. They're arriving supposedly through Logan. I'm not sure if this is like. I don't think there are any plot holes in this book, but maybe a continuity error, I mean. Because the AFR intercepted a bus, and it looked like the bus was in it for the long haul, so were the kids already off the plane, or were they going to the airport? That's one thing I don't quite understand. Maybe it doesn't matter so much, but again, that was just sort of a lapse in my understanding there. And then there's this interesting thread about an answering machine. And so Hal changes his answering machine quite often, and he's had Oosthuis do CT impressions on it before. He's had, this is the disembodied voice of Hal and Cadenza. You have not reached my real persona. And then also Pemulis, of course, is the king of all voice messages. So I just found that a funny quip that really just adds to the personalization of this narrative here. All right, next thread is that Joelle visits Gately at the hospital. Finally, we get a scene with them together at the hospital. We've been working up and alluding to this moment for a while because we know that Joelle has visited him quite a bit. Gately is, I want to say, hideously aware. He is brazenly aware that Joelle is Madame Psychosis. He's aware of her smell, her clothes, her words, the meaning behind her words. And I took that to mean that he's in recovery, that this is the first moment in the narrative where we know he's gonna live. We know he's gonna survive just by his observations of his partner, finally. So Joelle rather recounts a meeting to give Gately a meeting, which I found to be really sweet. I honestly don't think that this is a selfish act on her side. I really think that she is doing this for Gately's benefit. We know how dependent Gately is on meetings. I'm sure it's no secret. And I don't believe that all of Joelle's actions here are selfish. I know that she's inherently a selfish character. She has a lot of image issues, sure. But I really don't believe that this act in particular of sharing about the meeting is solely for her benefit. And Joelle actually has some really great breakthroughs here. The biggest one is that she realizes that the reason why she kept relapsing was because of this counting thing where it was like Evel Knievel, where he would jump over one car. That was like day one. Day two is two cars. Day three is three cars. And then after 14 days, it just looks like an immeasurably long stretch of cars that you can never jump over. And that's partly what caused her to relapse is her perspective on that. Gately also lives through a couple of his detox relapse phases in his life here. I won't get into those. But Gately also has an important breakthrough here about abiding. And abiding, capital A, is about staying in the moment, staying in the present, really being active in the present. And so we see at the end of this section here, this segment, Gately really making a conscious effort to abide with Joelle in that moment. Joelle also brings a photo album, and she's showing Gately pictures of her own personal daddy and of all the animals on her farm and telling stories about them. Another loose end here comes up, which is Gately, like, does some signals to Joelle, and it seems like he wants to write something, maybe write it on the window or something because he sees that it's cold outside. But oddly, he just never gets around to writing in this segment. My guess is that it's something we'll see next time, but yeah, it's weird. Weird. And there's this fantasy, again, between both of them, I think. You know, Joelle is doing this with her actions, with the photo album. Gately's doing this in his dream. But there's a fantasy about their relationship, you know, and everyone can sense that it's dangerous because Joelle is so early on in her recovery. People usually don't do relationships, serious ones at least, until a year after they're in recovery, because it's sort of that thing where you substitute one bad habit for another, and it's just an endless cycle that you can't break if you don't really investigate and look in. So Gately realizes that part of his motivation for this relationship is that he wants her to take care of this mess for him. He wants her to solve his problems with the parole, with the Canadians that are very injured, with Lens, and he does take this mode of thinking with a bit of disgust. That's what I am tasting in this narrative here. But it is still selfish thinking. He's aware of it, but it is still really selfish thinking, and he knows that. And again, this is another thing that's just so uncharacteristic of Gately. And without this event, without this narrative, we wouldn't have gotten this side of him. All right, second to last section here. It's first person again. I found this just jarring the second time as well. We know it's Hal still. It's very obvious from what Hal is doing here. He's in the bathroom. And the narrator, what I noticed at this point in the reading is that the narrator leaves Hal's thread. He leaves just the ETA thread altogether after Jim appears to Gately. So after this weird, like, Gately section with the Wraith, we don't see Jim or whomever the narrator is in the sections with Hal, which I don't know. I was sort of like, why? What are the mechanics of this? My thought here was that, is it because when Jim is with Gately, Hal has to take over, you know, because Jim can't be in two places at once? I have no idea. I was trying to think to other parts of the novel, you know, are there parts of the novel that are taking place simultaneously? Maybe so. I'm sure there are. But is that something that is limited somehow? I don't know. I'm just trying to figure out Jim's, like, Wraith powers, if he is the narrator. Just trying to figure out the mechanics of it all. And so I'll keep updating you with my thoughts. I want to hear your thoughts in the comments for this. Link in the description. So Hal is up pretty early. He's just stalking around the hallways. He's taking his cup, he's brushing his teeth and everything, and he finds Oostice in the hall, and Oostice is leaning against a window. We know it's snowing pretty badly at this point as well. So Hal stops, he's really good friends with the darkness, so he says, "Hey, what's up?" And Oostice is just in a terrible mood. It's really funny. He's just very moody. He's, wearing his classic trademark all black. To augment Oostice's mood, there are these sounds of boys, crying, making weird sounds, like in nightmares, that kind of thing, all throughout the hallway. So I just found it very cinematic again that Oostice is framed by this cacophony of sounds from the other ETA boys. And Oostice tells Hal this hilarious joke about three statisticians. And so there are three statisticians and they're going duck hunting. And so they're in the water, They have these big rifles with them. And there's a duck that flies up in the air. It's right in their range. The first statistician, shoots and he gets knocked back into the water or whatever, the ground, when he shoots and it's just under the duck. And so he's like, darn. And the next statistician, there's another duck, and he comes, and the next statistician fires, and he misses again. And he falls back, and it's just over the duck this time. And the third statistician is ecstatic. He goes, "We got one." I just thought it was really funny. I had to think about it for a long time, but then I just thought it was tremendously funny. So pause this, think about it if you don't get it, and then laugh, and then start playing this again. So we realize, like, literally at this point in the novel, that Oostice's forehead is stuck to the window. This is a big problem, but we've got a mind-boggling passage on page 870 really quickly first. And here's the yin to the yang of Jim's explanation earlier. Quote, "Himself allegedly used to see his father's ghost on stairways sometimes, but then again, toward the end, he used to see black widow spiders in his hair too, and claimed I wasn't speaking sometimes when I was sitting right there speaking to him. So we kind of wrote it all off. Orth, I guess I don't know what to think about paranormal." This is the missing piece of the puzzle here. We finally get this sense that there's a disconnect between Hal and his father. There's two different stories, and we're not sure which one is true. It seems like in the beginning, there's that scene with Hal, and himself is like being a fake shrink, and he's interviewing him, and he's in disguise, and Hal's like talking to him clearly, and the shrink slash Jim is like totally unaware. And for me, there's just sort of like they're on different wavelengths, right? And all of this mess with Infinite Jest is a product of that almost diseased relationship. And I think that gets at the premise of the book as a whole. The other thing I was thinking about with regards to this 870 passage is that these are pieces that I think Jim and Condensa wouldn't allow if he were involved in the narrative at this point. And by that I mean, I'm not sure he's so blind that, or maybe so gone or so dumb that if Hal had said that, if Hal had like really investigated that, Jim wouldn't notice. I think that Jim it would have been more aware, or Jim would have omitted that kind of thing from the narrative if he were still in charge at this point. So I don't know, I think Hal definitely takes charge in this section. Just because of the narrative style, the tense here, the actual thoughts and the conversations and how they're playing off, and all these comments in the narrative are just so much like Hal as we know him, at least as he's been presented to us in this novel so far. So I think Hal's in charge here, and again, I think there's sort of been this lapse of a narrator, and I'm racking my mind literally, who would allow this kind of lapse? Who is involved in the narration? Is it several people? Is it just one person? Is it omniscient? Is it DFW? An omniscient narrator, we would like to think, doesn't make mistakes. So That's one thing that I am keeping in mind because there are just mistakes. It's such a human narration. But anywho, we have Hal back with Ostice. He pulls Ostice off of the window, and Ostice's forehead skin literally comes off. It's like hanging by a thread. So he puts Ostice back, and he's like, "I need to go find help. I need to find like warm water to get you unstuck because this is bad." Then there's a little comment here about there's this like mad toothbrush tamperer. And so there are these toothbrush tamperings that began and then mysteriously stopped at ETA. And it's this little bit of magic that keeps happening at ETA, just like these mysterious objects appearing randomly in the kitchen and whatever places. And I just wanted to note that while we're continuing on here. I thought it was just the similarities between those two events that we've been hearing about are just too uncanny. Also, another mystery, Trollch comes out of Axe Handle's room for some reason, and there's sort of an alarm in Hal's narration as he's like, well, it's either him by himself, which doesn't make sense, or him and Axe Handle literally spent the night together in this little small dorm room. And I was just, I have no idea. And they don't question it. They are very socially aware of what's going on. Trollch doesn't seem to be, but yeah, it's just very strange. And especially that Hal notices this with such alarm is strange. So, must not be a normal situation. There's also a little bit of a jive about Kenkel and Brandt, these two janitors. And I took these two characters to just exemplify again that vestiges, like leftover parts of himself and himself's control over ETA are everywhere. They're everywhere, all around campus. You know, Pemulus has a scholarship named after him. And so, Kenkel and Brandt met himself for the first time on the T late at night, and he was lost and he was drunk, and they literally carried him back home. And they did really nice stuff with him, just making sure that he got home okay, that he got on the right train, that they didn't have to do. So himself gave them jobs at ETA. I have another quote about Phantauds on page 874. Quote, "People's nightmare cries gave them the Phantauds, them being Kenkel and Brandt." Now, here's one glimpse of the epilogue slash first chapter of the novel. Hal apparently looks mirthful when talking about Ostice and Ostice's situation. And this reminds me of the first scene of the novel because Hal is so unaware of what he's communicating to others. And so Kenkel, you know, gets close to him and he goes, "Why do you look so smug about this? Ostice seems to be in a lot of pain and whatever, in a real bind." And Hal goes, in his mind, he goes, "I thought I was doing like a deliberately neutral expression," and he just looks mirthful. So this is a bit of deliberate and amazing foreshadowing on DFW's part, but I do think it's something that foreshadows what's to come with Hal. All right, our last section for today. Page 876, partial transcript of weather-delayed meeting between 1. Mr. Rodney Tyne Sr., 2. Miss Maureen Hooley, 3. Mr. Carl E. Buster Yee, 4. Mr. R. Tyne Jr., 5. Mr. P. Tom Veals, 20th of November, YDAU. All right, to save my voice here, I'm going to just summarize this quite quickly. So all of these people are in a room, their conference room, they're talking about disseminating something. I was thinking, you know, is it Infinite Jest? And I was like, no, it can't be Infinite Jest because they mentioned quite early on that they are going to watch it themselves. So there's a target group of ages 4 to 12, and there's a pretty good live viewership rate of around 40% is their estimation. And they're gonna put it on this like kids channel. And it's a 30-second clip, so advertisement is what I was thinking, and I was correct. It's about Phil the Prancing Donkey, who's the second iteration of this whole idea about the advertisement. And essentially, the advertisement is telling kids to avoid suspicious or unlabeled cartridges and to also avoid the room if their parents are washing a cartridge for an absurd amount of time and they notice that time. And my guess is that somehow these characters involved. Yeah, we know that Rodney Tyne has connections with Steeply. I think they're preparing for the worst, especially if the AFR gets their hands on a master cartridge of some sort of Infinite Jest. But there's lots happening during this meeting besides just this conversation. It's really piecemeal, actually, what's the meat of this conversation that I've just described to you, because there's Yi, and he has epilepsy, and he keeps having epileptic fits at the table. Veals has this horrible, like, cold flu thing, and there's Rodney Tyne Jr. He has this ruler, and he keeps tapping the ruler, and Rodney Tyne has this pointer. It's just mayhem in this meeting, so similar to the puppet scenes that Mario indicated in his Interdependence Day show, which I found really funny and really poignant. But that is all for this episode today. I hope you enjoyed this change of pace, this double episode. I'm not sure if my voice could take another one of these for next week, but we'll definitely continue with the sections. We have two more sections left, you guys, until we finish Infinite Jest. I have been so grateful for you guys' support so far. It's been really awesome. I'm so excited, as you can probably tell, to finish this novel. I'm just so over the moon about it that we finished before the end of the year, as was our goal. So thank you for reading along with me. I'll see you next week, and then we'll continue with the novel. If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from us, there's a show and a series for everyone, so I'd recommend checking out our website, relevanceofliterature.com, under the Ongoing Series tab for links to our entire back catalog of episodes. We also have a couple of open surveys that you can find through the links in the description, so if you have 3 minutes while you're waiting in line somewhere, we would very much appreciate your feedback on our show. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode, and we'll see you next time.